copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I have two daughters. One is 9 years old. The other one is 6 years old. And 2 weeks from tonight, 2 weeks from today, I have my 64th birthday. So minimally, that means I need prayer. My kids are pretty good kids. My wife is very good taking care of them. And I tell that to people, and they say, yeah, wait until they become teenagers. And I say, if I'm lucky, I'll be dead by then. Got it all worked out. But lately, I have been enjoying my 9-year-old's kind of theological common sense. Just a few months ago, Easter, she was reading a book that we have that a friend of mine put together called I, Resurrection. It's kind of a pop-up book about different theories of the resurrection, advancing the truth of the resurrection. And kids like it, adults like it. And she was looking at some of the ideas, and we came upon one of these ideas. It's called the twin theory. I don't know if you've heard this before, but this is actually a legitimate theory out there. William Lane Craig did a debate with Dr. Greg Cavan at University of California, Irvine, just on this issue. And his idea, Dr. Cavan's idea, was that Jesus had an identical twin, and they were separated at birth. And the week of Jesus' passion, when Jesus was crucified, the twin walked into town and then presented himself to the apostles as the risen Christ, and he thought this was more likely than the resurrection. Anyway, I told my daughter that alternative. She had a 2-word response. She said, "That's dumb." Insight. And for, I wonder, how is it that a kid that old can see these kinds of things? The answer is that innocence sees the obvious, right? She asked me last week, Papa, why are they atheists? Why don't people believe in God? And I said, well, a number of reasons, honey. Partly because they can't see him, and they don't believe in what they can't see. And she said, well, can they see atoms? I said, well, you're on the right track there, I think, but here's what they would say to you. They'd say they can't see atoms, but they can measure them with scientific instruments, and so they're not going to believe anything that can't measure with scientific instruments. You can't measure God with a scientific instrument, and therefore they don't believe in him. And then she thought about that for a moment, and she said, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. And you wonder, how is it that a child like this can see that? And my daughter's not particularly extraordinary. She's just a kid who's thinking a little bit about this. And like I said, I think innocence sees the obvious. One big advantage she has is she hasn't gone to graduate school, So they teach you how to deny those obvious things in life. I think the insight my daughter had, though, when we talked about atheists last week is an insight to the inadequacies of naturalism. And that's what I want to address this evening. By the way, I take naturalism to be synonymous with materialism or physicalism. It's the idea that the only thing that exists is the material world driven by natural forces. And it's kind of captured by Carl Sagan's famous statement of faith, the cosmos is all there is, all there was or ever shall be. It sounds a little bit like the Gloria Patri, doesn't it? It's like the atheist's statement of faith. But I think that naturalism is daunting, and it's not only daunting in the States. I think it's especially daunting for you here in Europe because you have a whole culture that has been raised on naturalism their whole life. It's their knee-jerk reaction. You have people that never have even considered the legitimacy or the plausibility of Christ. And I'm sure that some of you are thinking, how could I make a dent in a point of view like that? And let me just offer you one thought, and it's a discovery that I had just this week at this session. Apparently, naturalism is so thoroughgoing that most naturalists have never, ever been exposed to even the most modest intellectual case for Christianity. So that if you make some comments or some statements or offer a line of thinking that seems modestly reasonable, oh, this really catches their attention. And I've actually heard that a number of times here where atheists will say, gee, I had no idea that there were these kinds of reasons. that could be offered for this kind of thing. Just in what David Robertson said a few moments ago hinted at that as well. I was stunned to find out there was actually a rational case for Christianity, as somebody said recently. So that should be encouraging. But I want to suggest this evening a kind of approach to dealing with naturalism. And the approach is based on the idea that we, as followers of Christ, have a very powerful ally in dealing with this worldview. And the ally is reality. In other words, we have reality on our side. And here's what I mean by that. I got this insight from Francis Schaeffer. Francis Schaeffer made the observation that, you know, Christianity is true. And if Christianity is true, then that means all human beings are made in the image of God, regardless of whether they believe it or not. And all human beings have to live in the world that God created, even if they don't believe in God. And therefore, naturalists who deny God's world, the living in reality, have got to be in denial of something real at some particular point. Now, keep in mind, what is reality? Reality is what you bump into, you know, when you don't take it seriously. It has a way of getting your attention. And so for naturalists, sooner or later, they're going to, after a fashion, bump into reality. They're going to affirm, and sometimes without even realizing it, they're going to affirm something, some features of reality that make no sense given naturalism, but make perfect sense given the Christian theistic worldview. And Francis Schaeffer called this the point of tension. That is, on the one hand, the naturalist will be speaking from his own worldview, and then on the other hand, sometimes even in the next breath, he is going to affirm things that have no place in his worldview at all. They make no sense with regards to naturalism. They fit perfectly into the Christian worldview, and at that point, they are bumping into reality. Now, he doesn't know that he's living in a contradiction. He's not thought about it enough. And I think about Richard Dawkins as a great example here. On the one hand, his view on morality is that morality is just a relativistic trick of evolution to help get our selfish genes into the next generation, right? And then in The God Delusion, you can read his tirade against the God of the Old Testament, a vindictive, bloodthirsty, homophobic, racist, genocidal, sadomasochistic, malevolent bully. You know, where's that coming from? That is not coming from his naturalism, is it? That is being informed by his bump into reality, because those words are not legitimate words the way he's using them in light of his naturalistic worldview. He's trading on our worldview, not on his. So we want, part of this strategy entails helping the naturalist see that he's living in a contradiction, that reality tells him something different about the world than what his worldview does. And I'll give you examples of that in a minute. But I want you to see something else here that I think we have a huge advantage of as followers of Christ. And that is that theism has explanatory power. And what I mean by that is there are many important details of the Christian worldview that actually fit the way the world really is. And they resonate with our deepest intuitions about morality. And by the way, this fit, when you have a point of view that fits the way reality is, that's the classical definition of truth, isn't it? And by contrast, if you have a point of view that does not fit reality, but actually goes against reality, that's a mark against the truthfulness of at least that point of your worldview. So the point here is that we want to exploit the idea that as followers of Christ, as we look at the world, understanding reality from God's perspective, that there are going to be all kinds of touchstones, important things in reality, significant details about existence that fit very nicely in our worldview, but turn out to be pointless with regards to naturalism. And when we see these things, we want to try to point these things out to the naturalist creatively. We want to do it shrewdly. We want to try to catch him by surprise sometimes with these kinds of discoveries. And this is what I call the tactical approach. And Alexander made reference to the book that he held up too briefly, in my opinion. But the title of the book is Tactics. And the subtitle is a game plan for discussing your Christian conviction. Thank you very much, Eller. You have redeemed yourself now. And part of the approach there is to maneuver with shrewdness in conversations, taking almost a low profile, not trying to do too much, asking a lot of questions, but being smart in the way you ask the questions. And I want to offer a qualifier here before I get into the specifics. And that is this particular approach that I'm suggesting, that you trade on reality, you make use of the naturalist, in a sense, bumping into reality. This is not a silver bullet. This is not going to, there's no magic approach, no perfect answer, no, you know, perfect apologetic that's going to get everybody to respond. And you know this from experience. But what we have found out from experience is this kind of approach is the kind of thing that will get people thinking. And so my goal in these kinds of conversations is to try to do something or say something that will plant a significant seed of doubt in that person's confidence in their own world view. Now, when I speak before non-Christian audiences, and I've spoken before quite a number of universities in the States, I always start my talks the same way. I tell them that I'm a follower of Christ, and I give a short characterization in non-religious language of what that means. And then I say, but I'm not here to convert you tonight. And it's almost like you can feel a collective sigh of relief. I said, I have a more modest goal. I just want to put a stone in your shoe. All right? I just want to annoy you in a good way. Now, of course, they expect me to annoy them, so I've said, all right, I'll annoy you. But you'll be happy when you're done, because I want you walking out of here, I tell them, kind of with something bothering you, scratching your head, wondering about something that I said that has now got you thinking. Because I am convinced, I tell them, that Christianity, the worldview of Jesus of Nazareth, is worth thinking about. And then off I go with my lecture and whatever it is that I have to say. But I want to commend this to you as an objective in these kinds of conversations. Just try to get them thinking. Try to get them, put a stone in their shoe. Help them to see that Christianity has explanatory power. And there are a lot of ways to do this, I think, to show them that their worldview bumps into reality. But I want to very briefly suggest three different bumps, if you will, bumps with reality that I think create serious worldview problems for the naturalist. And I'm just going to call them the bump of stuff, the bump of bad, and the bump of me, all right? And I'll have to do this quickly, but let's just start with the bump of stuff. A lot of times when I am talking with people, and I was at University of Toronto about 2 months ago, and the Q&A started, and the atheists lined up at the microphones to talk with me, and I traded on a very obvious fact. Stuff exists. Now, that's going to be very hard for an atheist to deny. And in one Q&A session, I had somebody challenge me. They said, prove to me God exists. And I said, well, you know, your challenge is a little bit loaded because I don't know what you mean by proof, and I don't know what would be persuasive for you personally, so can you reword your question? And so the person said, all right, well, how about can you just give me some reasons that God exists that might be compelling? I said, well, I can do that. And let me ask you a question first. Do you think things exist? Yeah, of course. Okay, yeah, fair enough. How about this one? Do you think things that exist have always existed? Is the universe eternal? No, it's not. You know, it came into existence at some point, Big Bang cosmology. Okay, so I'm pretty safe with those first two questions. Now, here's the key question that I asked them. Tell me, what caused things to come into existence? Well, I don't know. I'm not a scientist. Well, wait a minute. It's easy. You have one of two answers. Either something caused it or no thing caused it. What do you think? Now, this puts the naturalist, I think, in a very difficult position because he certainly acknowledges the existence of the material universe. But now we have a question about the cause of the universe, and they don't want to say that something caused the universe, because the minute they say something caused the universe, their naturalism is dead. Because the something that caused the universe has to be something that is outside of the natural order. And it has to be something adequate to the effect. It has to be powerful. It has to be probably reasonably intelligent. It has to be outside of time and space. And now you can see we're getting pretty close to the G word. But they're not going to want to say that. So they want to go for the nothing option. But this is something that just seems to me beyond reason. Now, here's what I want you to get from this illustration here about the bump of stuff right now. I am not going to argue that it is impossible for something to come from nothing. Now, I'm pretty convinced it is, but I don't have to do that with the naturalist. They are the ones that think they're trading on reason, right? So I'm going to ask the naturalist, what's the odds on favorite? So your wife comes home from work, and she sees the Mercedes-Benz SL sitting in the garage, brand spanking new, keys in the ignition. She said, honey, where did that Mercedes-Benz come? And you say, just appeared there out of nowhere. You know, things like that happen, you know. Well, things like that don't happen. The universe coming out of nothing, and by the way, I mean real nothing, not the something nothing of a Lawrence Krauss or a Stephen Hawking. The universe coming out of nothing is worse than magic. Because in magic, you have a magician who pulls a rabbit out of the hat, but now you don't have any hat. Plus, you don't have any magician. You just got the rabbit, the universe, just coming out of nowhere. Now, you might recognize this, some of you, as the Kalam cosmological argument. And Dr. William Lane Craig has done a great job of laying that out. But I'm going to give you a short course in the Kalam cosmological argument, which will save you a lot of money on books and will probably cost Bill Craig some royalties. But here it is. You ready? Write this down. A big bang needs a big banger. There you go. That pretty much covers it. Who was in the lobby on Sunday night when that big bang went off? Were you there? Some of you don't know this, but on Sunday night, what, 10:45? In the lobby, I now know what it was. It was an inner tube exploding because it had been pumped up too loud. But it sounded like actually worse than a gun. It sounded like an artillery shell had gone off. And everybody there in the lobby, in the bar, and everything, no matter how much they had to drink, went dead silent. And you know what everybody was thinking? They were thinking, what was that? But they didn't mean what was that. They knew what it was. It was a big bang. What they meant was what caused that. Do you see how natural that response is? Incidentally, I was sitting there in the bar by myself working on my talk, and I was right in the big bang section of my notes when the big bang happened in the lobby. And incidentally, nobody in that lobby was thinking, hey, the Big Bang banged itself. Now I want to show you that naturalists already know this, all right? Naturalists know this. I was at a dinner party once, religious leader in the States sitting to my right, his teenage son sitting across from me. And in the middle of the dinner party, the teenage son announced to the whole group of guests there at the dinner table that he was no longer a theist. Now he was an atheist, and in fact, he was quite belligerent about it. His father sitting next to me had never heard anything about this, and I felt a little bit embarrassed. And he went on and on and about how theism was irrational and etc. So, you know, I tried to have a conversation with him across the table. His father thanked me for that. It didn't do any good. Because he was so belligerent. Like I said, there's no magic bullet. And I did mention this about a big bang and a big banger and that kind of stuff. And all he did was just wave me off. And so I asked him, I said, listen, what if we were having dinner here and you suddenly heard a knock on the door? What would you think? Would you think that the knock knocked itself? Or especially if it's... Because there you get the design argument in there too, you know? No, you wouldn't think the knock knocked itself. You would get up and answer the door. No, blah, blah, blah. Totally disregarded me. So we were done with our conversation. Dessert came around, and as God is my witness, we hear on the front door right across the room a knock. Now, who knocks on doors anymore? We have doorbells, you know. So somebody was knocking on the door. And the young man across from me, the atheist, lifted his head up and looked around, and he said, "Who's there?" And I said, "No one." Now, here's the payoff. No clapping, no laughter. I don't have enough time for that. Here's the payoff. Even the atheist knew that the knock didn't knock itself. Because we live in a world of cause and effect, and when we have a significant effect like that, or even an insignificant one, it's meaningful to ask, what was the cause? We don't think it was uncaused without any purpose or reason, yet this is the very thing the naturalist seems to say much of the time regarding the entire universe. Naturalism cannot explain where stuff came from. They bump into stuff all the time. They can't make sense out of the ordinary things of the world. Christian theism can. And it can do so in a way that is consistent with our basic and deepest intuitions about the way the world actually is. That's the bump of stuff. Let's talk for a moment about the bump of bad. And I want to introduce this point just with a question. Just think for a moment what the most difficult challenge for many Christians, certainly the most frequently raised challenge to Christian theism is out in the world, and sometimes it's the most durable and very difficult to answer. It's called the what? Problem of evil. That's right. I want to just call that the bump of bad. We know when naturalists bump into bad in the world, every single time they raise the problem of evil. Now, I want to make a qualifier here, because there is a way of approaching the problem of evil in which the naturalist does not fall into the pit that I'm going to describe in a moment. And that's if the naturalist says, look, you Christians believe in a good God who is also powerful, and you Christians believe in the existence of evil in the world, and that entails an internal contradiction, therefore there's something wrong with your view. Now, that is a reasonably safe way of challenging the Christian worldview. I think there are answers to it, but I have almost never heard the objection stated that way. Characteristically, the way the objection is stated is, there is evil in the world. Look at the shootings, look at the killings, look at man's inhumanity to man. How can there be a God when there is so much evil in the world? And the minute that the naturalist bumps into bad that way, that they acknowledge the existence of objective evil, we have a powerful point we can make to them. And this is the way it plays out for me. First, if you're in a conversation, and this is what I do in a talk on this, you dream up the most morally grotesque thing you could possibly imagine. Sometimes the atheist has already supplied that for you. In my own talks, I talk about the Cambodian Holocaust, because in 1982, I lived in Thailand for 7 months working with Cambodian refugees that were the victims of that terrible massacre of 2 million people in 4 years. Sometimes I would describe that. Auschwitz is just up the road here a bit. There's an example. And if those don't work with your particular naturalist, try sexual slavery or global warming or secondhand smoke or George Bush or, you know, name your poison. Not your poison. Name their poison. You want to find out what pushes their moral hot button, whatever it happens to be. And once you've made this description, or maybe they've offered the description to you, you ask them what their assessment is of that. What do you make of this? How would you describe this? How would you evaluate this? And probably by this time, they're already giving their explanation that is, and what's the word on their lips? Evil. Maybe wicked. Maybe bad. But they're all identifying a detail about something you've just described. Now, here's the important question at this point. You have to ask them, I'm not clear on this. When you say those, when you use the word evil to describe that, do you mean to be describing the actions themselves, Or do you mean to be just describing your own personal feelings about those actions? Or do you mean to be describing just what your culture's point of view are about those actions? Now, this is when you listen. You ask them this. Now, if they are describing their own feelings, their own culture's point of view, do you realize that the substance of the objection to the problem of evil just disappears? Because if all somebody can say is, I don't like what they did, or my culture doesn't think that's a good thing, then there is no problem of evil, is there? When people raise the problem of evil, think of the way they say it. They say, how could there be a God when there is so much evil in the world? They are, without thinking about it, identifying objective evil, not subjective evil. The complaint against God, when somebody makes it in that way, based on the existence of evil in the world, requires that evil be objective. So now I have another question. Since they've already bumped into that part of reality, I have a question. As a naturalist, since they're the ones complaining about the problem of evil, how do you make sense of morality, good and bad, as a naturalist? How do you make sense? How do you get objective values, that things that have intrinsic worth, worth in themselves? How do you get objective duties, thou shalt and thou shalt not, in a world where all that exists is matter in motion? See, the problem here is if you bump into objective morality, objective moral law requires a transcendent moral law maker. And I'm just telling you, I don't have time to get into all the details. There is no way around this for them. And I've seen the answers. In fact, I've just written a piece, and I'm going to recommend it to you, and I'll give you a short summary of it to answer one challenge. If you go to str.org, right there on our homepage, there's a piece that I wrote called God, Evolution, and Morality, Part 1. The second part will come out in a few weeks and also be posted on our homepage. So there you'll get a lot more detail, but I just want you to notice one thing because, of course, the standard rejoinder to what amounts to the moral argument for the existence of God, the standard rejoinder is either Darwinism, evolution, or the social contract. And I have thought a lot about this, and so have a lot of other people. There are a lot of problems with that, but I want you to see the key one here. Remember that the problem of evil, for it to be a real problem, depends on the existence of objective evil. Now, objective evil is evil that is mind independent. Subjective evil is mind dependent. It's dependent on the person or maybe the group. Is rape wrong? Well, it depends what you mean. If the act is wrong in itself, regardless of what any mind thinks of it, well, then that's objective morality. But when you say rape is wrong and all you're talking about is your opinion or your group's decision, that's dependent on the subject. That's subjective morality. If it's subjective morality, you have no problem of evil. And now I want you to see something. When groups of people get together and establish the social contract and decide their rules for morality, is that mind independent morality or is that mind dependent morality? It's mind dependent. It's dependent on the group mind. And different groups have different minds on this matter. In other words, the social contract can only give you relativistic morality. What about Darwinism? What if it turns out that Darwinism is true and we've been evolved and our genes have chosen selfishly to manufacture ideas in our mind about morality that don't really fit the circumstances, but we believe in morality because we have been tricked by evolution? Is that kind of morality mind independent or mind dependent? That's mind dependent. Evolution cannot make rape wrong. All it can do is make people believe that rape is wrong for its own purposes. In other words, the only rejoinder that sounds even plausible to account for morality is evolution or the social contract, and in both cases, they can only produce relativistic morality, and if relativism is true, there is no problem of evil. Now, it seems to me the naturalist has one of two choices here. He can hang on to his relativism and then let go. There is no God, there is no morality, there's no problem of evil. Okay, he's got to pay that price. That's a big price for him to pay because he loves that argument against theism. And he knows too much about reality to be able to do that easily. Well, what's the other alternative? Well, you can hang on to the problem of evil, but you're going to have to let go of your atheism because it is not possible in a naturalistic world to make sense and ground objective moral obligations and duties and values apart from a person who, in our case, is whose character lays the foundation or the grounds for that kind of thing. Incidentally, if you want more detail about this, I wrote in the article, you can also check out William Lane Craig's On Guard, and he covers a lot of these bases in very accessible way. I interviewed on my own radio show a young lady named Holly Ordway. She was an atheist in the States, and she became a Christian over a period of time with a very gentle approach. A follower of Christ that very gradually poked her with reality, basically, and slowly but surely she became a Christian. She wrote her spiritual saga in a book called Not God's Type. It's a wonderful little book. I'm not sure if it's still in print. But what she said there is that she was an atheist and convinced she had no Christians around her. She had never considered Christian theism at all. She was an atheist, but she was also a moral realist. She wasn't a relativist. And she understood that this created a serious problem for her view. How could she be a moral realist? That's the bump with reality. And be an atheist at the same time. That got her thinking. But there's something else that she noticed. She noticed that the more that she pursued atheism, the more that her soul was corrupted. And one of the things that attracted her to Christianity is having a PhD in literature, in medieval literature, she was reading Chaucer and Milton and others like that, and she was taken with the beauty of what they produced. And she knew, she told me this herself, she knew that the beauty of their writings flowed out of their Christian worldview. The beauty of their writings flowed out of their love for God and their convictions about Jesus. And this kind of caught her attention. And this brings me to the last bump. I'm calling it the bump of me, and this is the existential crisis. This is the personal issue. But the conversation about the personal existential crisis that we all face, including naturalists, is grounded in part on the existence of the soul. And I just learned today that there were two sessions where there was discussion about the soul at this week, and I'm so glad to hear this because I think we do not talk enough about the soul. Consciousness is a serious problem for the naturalist, and a lot of them are acknowledging it nowadays. And some of you might know about the American philosopher Thomas Nagel, who has written a book. He's an atheist and still a deeply committed atheist, but has written a book called Mind and Cosmos. And the subtitle is How the Darwinistic Naturalistic View of the World is Almost Certainly False. Now, he's created quite a firestorm, but he's willing to stand up and take the heat, partly because of his own trade, and that is the philosophy of mind. He realizes that consciousness cannot be accounted for on a naturalistic worldview. And lots of guys have done, you know, a lot of hand-waving and arm-twisting and put themselves into contortions trying to do that, but they haven't been able to do that. So much so that Daniel Dennett, the American new atheist, has now admitted that he thinks that consciousness is an illusion. Now, this is so silly that it almost doesn't deserve a response, but let me just offer one. When you hear somebody say, well, consciousness is an illusion, you ask them, what is an illusion? Isn't an illusion when your consciousness is appeared to falsely? I mean, rocks don't have illusions. Only conscious beings can have illusions. So if consciousness is having an illusion, is the illusion having an illusion? This is wildly self-refuting. It just seems obviously false to me. And it shows the kind of trouble that naturalists are in trying to deal with this piece of reality, the soul. And I just want to say three things very quickly about the soul that are important here that you can leverage in your conversations with naturalists. And the first one is that people know that they have a soul, or maybe I should say they are a soul. Souls are real, and they know this, even if they deny it. Think about it for a moment. The soul is the one thing that you are in constant contact with every waking moment of your life. Now remember, a soul is what you're aware of when you introspect, okay? So all of my thoughts running through my head as I'm talking to you, these are all activities of my soul. I'm right in touch with it. It has only been in recent times that any serious people have ever denied the soul because everybody's directly in touch with the soul. And in case your friend is still a skeptic, I'll give you a little exercise you could do with them. And I've done this before, and others have used this, and I might have gotten this from my own mentor, J.P. Moreland. I'm not sure, but it's effective. So I'm going to do the exercise with you. It'll take you about 30 seconds, all right? I want you to close your eyes for a moment, and I want you to imagine something. Close your eyes and imagine your mother. Your mother is standing at the sink. She is doing dishes. Now, here's my question. Now that you see her, what color blouse is she wearing? Okay, now open your eyes. What color blouse was she wearing? Red. Mine was yellow. I don't know. You guys have. Now, here's my final question. Where was that? Where was your mother with the yellow or the red or the purple blouse washing dishes? Where was that image? I'll tell you one place it wasn't. It wasn't in your brain. Because if it was in your brain, at least in principle, if we cracked your brain open, we'd see your mother in there washing dishes. But you know we're never going to do that. Now, some people might say, well, those C fibers that are firing, and they'll talk about the biochemistry and everything. And, well, maybe that was going on. And people who know more about this than I do are probably right, but that's not what you saw. You did not see C fibers firing. You saw your mother. And minimally, this shows that colors are not wavelengths of light because you can see color where there is no light. In fact, you can see color. I mean, you can experience every one of your five senses without any physical stimuli of any kind. You just had the sight one, sound. How about Beethoven's Fifth? Didn't you hear it? Dun, 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 dun. And there's no physical equipment that can pick that up. But you heard it. You can feel. You can feel fur. I don't have fur, but, you know, I'm just doing that. You can taste a strawberry. You can smell a rose all in your mind. Now, it's not as acute or dramatic as in the physical reality, but those are all real things. Where are they happening? I just said it. In your what? In your mind. These are all happening in a non-physical space, and they are real. In fact, they're so real you saw it. And I use this as an illustration to put a stone in people's shoes to get them thinking. The other thing that they know about the soul is not only they have one, but that there's something wonderful about being human and it's not physical. This is why we talk about human rights or equal rights, because human beings are the kinds of creatures we ought to treat in a very special way. Now, I understand some people are getting a little confused on this particular issue and don't see the distinctions between the animal kingdom and the human kingdom. But when they're not thinking about it, they bump into this part of reality too. This is why we can gas termites and not human beings. This is why ethnic cleansing is so awful, because we are disqualifying some human value based on some physical characteristic. We know humans are special. We know they're valuable. But naturalists have no reason to believe this. And this is part of the existential crisis for naturalists, because naturalism reduces us to cosmic junk, to biological accidents, to just pieces of matter stuck together. No wonder they call it nihilism, nothingism. And when people start believing in nothingism about human beings, bad things happen. They know the soul exists. They know that humans are valuable. They also know that there's something wrong. We're valuable, we're beautiful, but we're broken. We're not physically sick. We are spiritually broken. We are morally to blame. Some of you might have read the testimony of the French former atheist, now Christian theologian, Guillaume Bignon, B-I-G-N-O-N, and my apologies to my French-speaking brethren. I probably messed that up. But I spelled it out for you because you look it up. How did I put it? I got to find it now. B-I-G-N-O-N. It's a great story, but he told it to me last fall. I met him in the States, and he said that a series of things happened, but at one point, he said, God reactivated my conscience. Some certain evidences for God got his attention. God reactivated my conscience, and that was not a pleasant experience. He said, I was crippled by guilt, not knowing what to do about it. And then he realized this is why Jesus died, and he gave his life to Christ. I spoke at Berkeley, lectured there a few years back. Huge audience on Friday night. Gave a talk about relativism. And when I was done showing that relativism was inadequate, I talked about this means that some form of moral objectivism must be true. And I said this has explanatory power because there's something that every single person in this audience experiences. Guilt. You all experience it. Now, what am I doing here? Am I offering an intellectual argument? No, I'm skirting the intellectual stuff, and I'm going right to the existential experience. In fact, the way I played this out, I got the audience to admit it, that they were guilty. I asked them certain questions. And then I said, listen, why do we feel guilty? Why is that? I don't know. We have different explanations. How about this? Maybe we feel guilty because we are guilty. Is that in the running? Is that a possibility? And if we feel guilty because we are guilty, denial is not the answer. That's relativism. The answer to guilt, I said, is forgiveness. And this is where Jesus comes in. You see, as followers of Christ, we have explanatory power. We can look around about the universe and we can see things that are real that we bump into that make sense in our worldview. We can make sense of the existence of the world. We can make sense of the problem of evil. We can make sense of our own deep human experiences, especially the pressing problem of guilt. And by contrast, in each of these areas, the naturalist has nothing to say. Intellectually, Christian theism proves to be a much more satisfying answer. Existentially, Christian theism is the only answer. And my simple suggestion for you is this. Watch for when your naturalist friend bumps into reality. Then point it out graciously, clearly. Use questions as much as you can, but poke them with reality. It's no silver bullet, but it might just put a stone in their shoe. It might just get them thinking that Christianity is worth thinking about. Father, we have a challenging task as your followers in the midst of an increasingly hostile culture. We have the task of taking good news and helping people to see how good it really is. We ask that you would help us each in our own spheres of influence as we lead, as we train, as we engage individually those who have not found you, have not understood, who are lost in darkness. We ask that you help us be effective. Give us the courage to stand up in the line of fire, not being afraid of what the world has for us, not being afraid of what they dish out, but being willing to speak the truth in love, having sanctified Christ as Lord in our hearts. We depend on you. We need you. We trust you, and we love you, and we thank you. Amen.